never be considered in isolation from their purpose. Napoleon had a political aim when he crossed the Niemen. It was to secure Alexander I's compliance with the continental system, the embargo on trade with Great Britain that the French were trying to impose on Europe after the British Navy blockaded their ports. He'd do this by defeating the Russians quickly, accepting capitulation graciously, and then crossing the Niemen in the opposite direction before leaves began to fall. He'd keep his ends within means, thereby achieving proportionality. And why wouldn't this work? Napoleon was, after all, a genius. Far from standing, fighting, and losing, however, as most of Napoleon's previous foes had done, the Russians retreated, scorching the earth through which they passed, of which, unlike most Europeans, they had no shortage. That's what Tolstoy's Clausewitz meant by extending the war in space to weaken the enemy. No army strengthens itself by outrunning its supply lines. Retreat, in turn, extended the war in time. The farther the French advanced, the longer it would take for them to get back. Napoleon might have stopped at this point, admitted his miscalculation, and ordered a withdrawal. But, Xerxes-like, he refused. That would be never to finish anything. And so Napoleon forgot the strategy with which he'd begun. My campaign plan is a battle, and all my politics is success. He got the battle in early September at Borodino, but not success, for despite heavy losses, Alexander refused to negotiate. And when Kutuzov decided that he couldn't defend Moscow, Napoleon took what turned out to be bait, finding only a burned-out husk. Only then did the genius start doubting himself, long after his army had begun to. That shifted the psychological balance, which, at such moments, Clausewitz reminds us, becomes the military balance. The war did, in fact, take place, therefore, across space, time, and scale, this last being the fears and hopes of each Russian and French soldier, as well as the only French emperor. The same confidence that led Napoleon to Moscow in 1812, Clausewitz concludes, left him there. 5. Tolstoy captures the moment on page 993 of War and Peace by having a hungry Cossack kill a hare and wound another, chasing it into a forest, where he encounters, instead, a large but unguarded French army encampment. Kutuzov, expecting little, orders an attack, but his troops surprise him by winning a complete victory, their first since Napoleon invaded. With the least strain, with the greatest confusion, and with the most insignificant losses, Tolstoy writes, the greatest results of the whole campaign were achieved. The Battle of Tarutino, fought on October 18th, provided the push for which Napoleon's army was only waiting to begin its flight. So did history pivot here on a hare? Probably not, just as Clausewitz didn't really ride into a novel on a horse. Turning points do often originate, however, below historians' radars. That only imagination evokes them doesn't diminish their significance, for what documents could show a great army losing its confidence overnight? Tarutino was a far less bloody fight than Borodino, but it came just as Napoleon no longer knew what to do. By the time he'd decided on a retreat, he'd lost the authority to prevent confusion, then panic, and then an epic rout. The Fabian system of warfare, which succeeded in our Revolutionary War, John Quincy Adams wrote his father from St. Petersburg, where he was serving as the first American minister to Russia, probably was never brought to a severer test. But the modern Alexander may be destined, like his predecessor, to be arrested in his career of domination by the Scythians. Adams' family correspondence was often this kind of classical crossword puzzle. Fabius Maximus Cunctator had exhausted Hannibal by allowing him to invade Italy in the Second Punic War, the modern Alexander was Napoleon, and the Scythians were Russians, not the nomads the ancient Alexander had once vanquished. Soon, though, John Quincy was sparing his mother nothing. Of the immense host with which 6 months since Napoleon invaded Russia, 9/10 at least are prisoners or food for worms. From Moscow to Prussia, 800 miles of road have been strewed with his artillery, baggage wagons, ammunition chests, dead and dying men, whom he has been forced to abandon to their fate, pursued all the time by 3 large regular armies of a most embittered and exasperated enemy, and by an almost numberless militia of peasants, stung by the destruction of their harvests and cottages, and spurred to revenge at once by themselves, their country, and their religion. 2 Russian generals, Famine and Frost, had completed the destruction, so that in all human probability, the career of Napoleon's conquests is at an end. France can no longer give law to the continent. A new era is dawning upon Europe. 6. Genius, Clausewitz writes, does not consist in a single appropriate gift, courage, for example, while other qualities of mind or temperament are not suited to war. Instead, it requires a harmonious combination of elements, in which one or the other ability may predominate, but none may be in conflict with the rest. It demands, in short, an ecological sensibility. The man responsible for evaluating the whole must bring to the task the quality of intuition that perceives the truth at every point. Otherwise, a chaos of opinions would arise and fatally entangle judgment. How, though, can anyone perceive truth at every point? Clausewitz answers by linking strategy to imagination. Artists approach truth, he observes, with a quick recognition of what the mind would ordinarily miss or would perceive only after long study and reflection. His term for this is coup d'œil, or an inward eye. It's what Machiavelli meant by sketching, conveying complexity usably. Complexity fully rendered would take too long and contain too much, thereby entangling judgment. Complexity, as what you want or expect, would only confirm what you think you know. You need something in between. So when your troops get sick, or their horses begin to starve, or czars don't follow the scripts you've written for them, you sketch what you know and imagine, informed by the sketch, what you don't. This allows recovering from surprises and moving on. Strategists and artists are, therefore, on the same page in Clausewitz, or, more accurately, pages, given the hundreds he left behind. But how can planning anticipate surprises? Only by living with contradictions, Clausewitz maintains. Everything in war is very simple, but the simplest thing is difficult. He elaborates in a passage Tolstoy could have written. Imagine a traveler who late in the day decides to cover 2 more stages before nightfall. Only 4 or 5 hours more on a paved highway with relays of horses. It should be an easy trip. But at the next station he finds no fresh horses, or only poor ones. The country grows hilly, the road bad, night falls, and finally, after many difficulties, he is only too glad to reach a resting place with any kind of primitive accommodation. It is much the same in war. The military grammar of discipline can, in theory, overcome such problems, and in practice, for a time, it does. In the end, though, a larger logic of friction sets in, degrading the functioning of the multiple parts on which armies depend. Once conditions become difficult, as they must when much is at stake, things no longer run like a well-oiled machine. The machine itself begins to resist, and the commander needs tremendous willpower to overcome this resistance. It need not consist of disobedience and argument, though this occurs often enough in individual soldiers. It is the impact of the ebbing of moral and physical strength, of the heart-rending spectacle of the dead and wounded, that the commander has to withstand, first in himself, and then in all those who have entrusted him with their thoughts and feelings, hopes and fears. As each man's strength no longer responds to his will, the inertia of the whole gradually comes to rest on the commander's will alone. The ardor of his spirit must rekindle the flame of purpose in all others. His inward fire must revive their hope. Only to the extent that he can do this will he retain his hold on his men and keep control. Something or someone will sooner or later break, but you can't know how, where, or when. What you can know is that, owing to friction, one always falls far short of the intended goal. 7. Clausewitz, in one sense, says nothing new here. Asymmetries in aspirations and capabilities have always constrained strategies, which is one of the reasons they're needed in the first place. He's highly original, though, in specifying friction as the cause, while showing that it can occur at any level. The passage of time and extension across space make it more probable. Perhaps he knew that Napoleon's carriage on the advance to Moscow required having water poured onto its wheels to prevent overheating. Just as coup d'oeil links strategy to imagination, so Clausewitz's concept of friction ties theory to experience. These must never disdain or exclude each other, he writes. On the contrary, they support each other. That places uncertainty within a universal framework. Or, to put it another way, Clausewitz anticipates, by more than a century, Murphy's Law. That what can go wrong will. Or, still more succinctly, shit happens. Napoleon, in theory, knew this. That's why, despite his limited objectives, he crossed the Niemen with such an enormous force. Xerxes at the Hellespont did the same. Both sought to overcome friction by intimidating their enemies. Neither saw, though, that the retreat of a foe can become resistance, owing to the ascending costs of protracted pursuits. Both, for this reason, wore out their military machines, to the point that further advances emboldened adversaries, not themselves. Thermopylae and Borodino showed that Greeks and Russians weren't afraid. Salamis and Tarutino revealed that Persians and French now were. Where, then, did Xerxes and Napoleon go wrong? They failed, Clausewitz would probably say, to perceive truth at every point, which in these instances meant landscapes, logistics, climates, the morale of their troops, and the strategies of their enemies. They missed what their own soldiers understood, that Greece and Russia were traps, just as the English Channel was for the Spanish Armada. The good general, Clausewitz concludes, must know friction in order to overcome it whenever possible, and in order not to expect a standard of achievement in his operations which this very friction makes impossible. But why did Xerxes and Napoleon so limit peripheral vision, as if they were carriage horses wearing blinders? There are many examples, Clausewitz tells us, of men who show great determination as junior officers, but lose it as they rise in rank. Conscious of the need to be decisive, they also recognize the risks entailed by a wrong decision. Since they are unfamiliar with the problems now facing them, their mind loses its former incisiveness. The more used they had been to instant action, the more their timidity increases as they realize the dangers of the vacillation that ensnares them. And so they stare straight ahead, listening to no one, fearing distractions, clinging to command, even as it leads them into disaster, thereby confirming the high-altitude rarity of common sense. Where, in an Alice in Wonderland world of weary genius, a horse can become a hedgehog, then a bewildered dog scuttling home. 8. If we then ask, Clausewitz writes, what sort of mind is likeliest to display military genius, experience and observation will both tell us that it is the inquiring rather than the creative mind, the comprehensive rather than the specialized approach, the calm rather than the excitable head to which in war we would choose to entrust the fate of our brothers and children. He elaborates no further in On War, but Tolstoy does in War and Peace, in the contrast he draws between Napoleon and Kutuzov. Napoleon appears most memorably in the novel's portrayal of a real event, his meeting with General Alexander Balashov, the Tsar's aide-de-camp, in Vilnius on July 1st, a week after the French crossed the Niemen. The emperor expects an offer of negotiations, but when Balashov insists that Alexander won't extend one as long as a single French soldier remains on Russian soil, Napoleon's face starts twitching and his left calf trembling. He began to speak in a higher and more hurried voice than before. The more he speaks, the less he controls himself, quickly reaching that state of irritation in which a man has to talk and talk and talk, only so as to prove his rightness to himself. Know that if you stir up Prussia against me, I will wipe her off the map of Europe. I'll hurl you back beyond the Dvina, beyond the Dnieper, and rebuild that barrier against you which Europe was criminal to have allowed to be destroyed. Yes, that's what will happen to you. That's what you've gained by distancing yourselves from me. The emperor stalks angrily around the room, sniffing from his snuffbox. Suddenly he stops, looks into Balashov's eyes, and says, menacingly but also wistfully, "What a fine reign your master might have had." After which Napoleon invites his guest to a friendly dinner, where he says nothing at all about what's occurred. Mistakes, Tolstoy notes, are no longer possible for him. To his mind, everything he did was good, not because it agreed with any notion of what was good and bad, but because he did it. And so Napoleon winds up exalting himself and insulting Alexander, the thing he at least wanted to do at the beginning of the meeting. Tolstoy shows Kutuzov, in a fictional scene, arriving at his headquarters, dismounting with difficulty, and wheezing up steps. There he embraces Prince Andrei, whose father has just died. The old commander then asks for the report he's come to hear, while taking more interest in the sounds his mistress is making in the next room. He could not be surprised by anything the general on duty could tell him, Tolstoy explains, for he knew beforehand everything he was being told and listened to it only because he had to listen, as one has to listen to the singing of a prayer service. But when he learns that the French, maybe even the retreating Russians, have sacked Andrei's family estate, Kutuzov bursts out indignantly, "See? See what they've brought us to?" He adds, though, that it's hard to win a campaign. For that, one needs patience and time. These, he promises Andrei, will force the French to eat horse flesh for me. At which point his only eye, the other having been lost long ago in combat, glistens with tears. Andrei returns to his regiment relieved with regard to the general course of things, and to the man to whom it had been entrusted. Kutuzov, he knows, will never invent anything, but he'll listen to everything, remembering everything, put everything in its place, won't hinder anything useful or allow anything harmful. He understands that there is something stronger and more significant than his will, the inevitable course of events, and he's able to see them, able to understand their significance, and, in view of that significance, is able to renounce his personal will and direct it elsewhere. And the main reason why one believes him is that his voice trembled when he said, "See what they've brought us to?" and had a catch in it when he said he'd make them eat horse flesh. Kutuzov leads from a lower altitude than Napoleon. That keeps his head out of his own clouds. He may doze off, but he never forgets what he set out to do. And so, Tolstoy writes, despite the Tsar's doubts, widespread approval accompanied the people's election of Kutuzov as commander-in-chief. 9. Long before Virgil took Dante through hell, he was tutoring Octavian on the fundamentals of beekeeping, cattle breeding, crop rotation, and vine cultivation. Leaders, he seemed to be saying, must keep their feet on the ground. Clausewitz thinks similarly. He'd avoided no logical conclusions in his writings, he explains, but whenever the thread became too thin, I have preferred to break it off, just as some plants bear fruit only if they don't shoot up too high, so in the practical arts the leaves and flowers of theory must be pruned and the plant kept close to its proper soil, experience. How, though, do you prune theory? By not asking too much of it, Clausewitz replies. It would indeed be rash to deduce, from any particular reality, universal laws governing every single case, regardless of all haphazard influences. But those who never rise above anecdote, those indefatigable repeaters of pointless stories, are equally useless, for they would construct all history of individual cases, digging only as deep as suits them, never getting down to the general factors that govern the matter. Theory exists, so that one need not start afresh each time sorting out the material and plowing through it, but will find it ready to hand and in good order. It is meant to educate the mind of the future commander, or, more accurately, to guide him in his self-education, not to accompany him to the battlefield. Just as a wise teacher guides and stimulates a young man's intellectual development, but is careful not to lead him by the hand for the rest of his life. Clausewitz sees theory, then, as training. It's what hardens the body for great exertions, strengthens the heart in great peril, and fortifies judgment against first impressions. It's the lubricant that reduces friction. It breeds that priceless quality, calm, which, passing from hussar and rifleman up to the general himself, will lighten the commander's task. Troubles come not from embracing theory as a beginner, but from clutching it too closely while rising, a practice that defies common sense. Theory then becomes an excuse through which limited and ignorant minds justify their congenital incompetence. Clausewitz especially despises the jargon, technicalities, and metaphors that swarm at high altitudes, a lawless rabble of camp followers torn from context and enlisted as principals. The light of day usually reveals them to be mere trash, making theory the very opposite of practice, and not infrequently the laughingstock of men whose military competence is beyond dispute. An example was Clausewitz's former instructor in the Prussian War School, General Karl Ludwig von Pfuel, who, by 1812, had become a top military advisor to Tsar Alexander. Pfuel, Clausewitz wrote confidently at the time, was a man without a knowledge of actual things, among them how best to deploy the Russian army against Napoleon. It's unlikely that Tolstoy ever saw that comment, but he conveys clearly, in War and Peace, what Clausewitz thought. Pfuel was one of those theorists who so love their theory that they forget the purpose of the theory, its application in practice. In his love for theory, he hated everything practical and did not want to know about it. He was even glad of failure, because failure, proceeding from departures from theory in practice, only proved to him the correctness of his theory. Tolstoy ends his scene by having Fuel acknowledge the respectful but skeptical Andrei, an eerie stand-in for Clausewitz, with a disdain of a man who knows beforehand that it will all go badly and who is not even displeased by that. It's one of many points at which Tolstoy seems to be finishing Clausewitz's book, like close couples who finish each other's sentences. Nowhere is this clearer than in what each says about the role of chance in war and in life. 10. No other human activity is so continuously or universally bound up with chance, Clausewitz writes of war in On War. It's a paradoxical trinity, composed of the passions that cause combatants to risk their lives, the skill of their commanders, and the coherence of the political objectives for which the war is being fought. Only the last is fully governed by reason. The others inhabit the murky realms of emotion, where all the usual landmarks seem to have disappeared. What's needed, then, is a theory that maintains a balance between these three tendencies, like an object suspended between three magnets. But anyone who's experimented with magnets will know, Clausewitz surely did, that the difference between two and three, when a pendulum swings freely above them, looks like that between order and chaos. The third magnet shifts the oscillation from regularity to apparent randomness, or, in mathematical terms, from linearity to non-linearity. Clausewitz's magnets force us to ask, therefore, how a theory can balance behaviors that seem themselves to be, in their relation to one another, unbalanced. Not by promising certainty, Clausewitz replies. He places theory within the category of rules to which there can be exceptions, not laws that allow none. He values theory as an antidote to anecdotes, as a compression of the past transmitting experience, while making minimal claims about the future. He relies on theory for training, not as a navigational chart for the unforeseen. He trusts coup d'oeil more than quantification. Any reduction of war to numbers would not stand up for a moment against the realities of life. And he distrusts novices who, without theory, will lack judgment, which must work like a ship's compass, recording the slightest variations from courses set, however rough the sea. Roughness originates, Clausewitz tells us, in sources known, if at all, only to those who were on the spot. Like the movements of a pendulum above three magnets, it can be as difficult to anticipate as auroras, blizzards, and earthquakes were to the first Kennan's remote Siberians. War, for Clausewitz, is like that. The recorders of it is wrapped in a fog. Comprehension requires a sensitive and discriminating judgment, a skilled intelligence to scent out the truth, which won't come from theories built only on what theorists, through their blinders, think they can measure. Such simplifiers, Tolstoy adds, completing the argument, are like workmen assigned to plaster a church wall who, taking advantage of the foreman's absence, in a fit of zeal, smear their plaster all over the windows, the icons, and the scaffolding, delighted with how, from their plastering point of view, everything comes out flat and smooth. Tolstoy is the least plasterer-like of novelists, as is Clausewitz among theorists of war. There's nothing flat or smooth about either of them. They seek out irregularities at the edge of chaos, which is, or appears to be, the realm of chance. 11. Where Clausewitz is content to leave it, but not the pit bull Tolstoy, who's so determined on further attack that he abandons his characters well short of the end of War and Peace, devoting its final pages instead to a relentlessly ponderous search for chance within the polarity of determinism versus freedom. Here's his conclusion. The new methods of thinking which history should adopt for itself are being worked out simultaneously with the self-destruction towards which, ever subdividing and subdividing the causes of phenomena, the old history is moving. All of mankind's sciences have followed this path. Having arrived at the infinitely small, mathematics, the most exact of sciences, abandons the process of subdividing and starts on a new process of summing up the unknown infinitesimals. Renouncing the concept of cause, mathematics seeks laws, that is, properties common to all unknown infinitely small elements. Other sciences, though in a different form, have followed this same path of thinking. When Newton formulated the law of gravity, he did not say that the sun or the earth has the property of attraction. He said that all bodies, from the largest to the smallest, have this property of attracting each other. History stands on the same path. And if history has for its subject of study the movements of peoples and of mankind, and not the description of episodes from people's lives, it should set aside the notion of causes and seek for the laws common to all the equal and inseparably bound together infinitely small elements of freedom. What Tolstoy means here, I think, is A, that because everything connects with everything else, there's an inescapable interdependency across time, space, and scale. Forget about distinguishing independent from dependent variables. B, that, as a consequence, there'll always be things that can't be known. Breaking them into components won't help, because there'll always be smaller components. C, that owing to what we can't know, we'll always retain an illusion of agency, however infinitesimal. D, that while laws may govern these infinitesimals, they make no difference to us, because we can't feel their effects. Therefore, E, our perception of freedom is, in practice, freedom itself. If I've got this right, then Tolstoy has used scale to solve an ancient problem. How, if God is omnipotent, can man have free will? Being Tolstoy, though, his answer didn't satisfy him, and he soon reverted to the belief in God he'd once derided as the habit of primitives. He even tried, not very successfully, to become primitive himself. But if considered, alongside Clausewitz, as a commentary, in advance, on F. Scott Fitzgerald, on how to hold opposing ideas in mind at the same time while retaining the ability to function, then Tolstoy's reasoning has significant implications for strategy in the largest sense. 12. Begin with theory and practice, both of which Clausewitz and Tolstoy respect without enslaving themselves to either. It's as if, in their thinking, abstraction and specificity reinforce each other, but never in predetermined proportions. Each situation requires a balancing derived from judgment and arising from experience, skills acquired by learning from the past and training for the future. Theory reduces history's complexity to teachable moments. It's not the reductionism of Tolstoy's plasterers, who smooth over irregularities in search of predictability. Instead, theory functions, with respect to the past, as Clausewitz's coup d'oeil do in the present. It extracts lessons from infinite variety. It sketches, informed by what you need to know, without trying to tell you too much. For in classrooms, as on battlefields, you don't have unlimited time to listen. Theory, then, serves practice. And when practice corrects theory, when it removes theorists' horse blinders, it returns the favor, preventing stumbles off cliffs, into swamps, and toward Moscow. An artist, when sketching, looks at a landscape and then a sketch pad, repeating the process until an image appears, depicting but not duplicating what's there. Landscape and sketch pad guide the artist's hand, but no two artists will sketch the scene in just the same way. It's a dependent yet distinctive reciprocity, without which no balancing of reality and representation can occur. The modern term for sketching in strategy is net assessment, an evocation, never simply a list, of the elements in environments most likely to determine outcomes. If done well, it will include knowns, geography, topography, climate, your own capabilities, the objectives you're seeking, probabilities, the goals of adversaries, the reliability of allies, the constraints of cultures, your country's capacity to endure adversity, and, finally, a respectful acknowledgement of the unknowns that will lurk in the intersections of the first two. Like Clausewitz's magnets, the configuration is triangular, although in two ways. For as you balance knowns, probabilities, and unknowns, you're also doing so across time, space, and scale. In war, as in life generally, Clausewitz explains, all parts of a whole are interconnected, and thus the effects produced, however small their cause, must influence all operations and modify their final outcome to some degree, however slight. And so he anticipates Tolstoy on infinitesimals. Not, however, because Clausewitz sees the future. It's rather because he and Tolstoy have seen, in the past, the face of battle, from which they know that ends, potentially infinite, can never be means, which are poignantly finite. That's why war, explicitly in Clausewitz, implicitly in Tolstoy, must reflect policy. For when policy reflects war, it's because some high-level hedgehog, a Xerxes or a Napoleon, has fallen in love with war, making it an end in itself. They'll stop only when they've bled themselves bloodless. And so the culminating points of their offensives are self-defeat. Overstretch, the enfeeblement that comes with confusing ends and means, allows enemies to apply leverage, small maneuvers that have big consequences. Themistocles wouldn't have won at Salamis without spinning a Delphic oracle. Elizabeth trusted her admirals to trust the winds. And Kutuzov could safely slumber after Borodino, certain that geography, topography, and climate, the knowns Napoleon had ignored, would drive the French out even if the Russians did nothing. The border would be the golden bridge the enemy would want to cross to get home. Kutuzov's bridge could serve as grand strategy's gold standard. For if ends are to fit within available means, then solvency and morality, practicality and principle, demand that they do so with the least possible expenditure of resources and lives. The means to be employed must be proportioned to the extent of the mischief, Hamilton writes in The Federalist, and however much the astonishments of their age may have haunted Clausewitz and Tolstoy, both saw their books as paths back to proportionality. On War and War and Peace, incessantly and at epic length, balance opposites. That's where proportionality, the simultaneous comprehension of contradictions, comes from. Theory versus practice. Training versus improvisation. Planning versus friction. Force versus policy. Situations versus sketches. Specialization versus generalization. Action versus inaction. Victory versus defeat. Love versus hate. Life versus death. Leading from within clouds versus keeping the ground in view. But no versus whatever between art and science. It's not too much to suggest, therefore, that Clausewitz and Tolstoy together are, in the amplitude, imagination and honesty with which they approach these great issues, the grandest of strategists. Chapter 8. The Greatest President. John Quincy Adams doesn't appear in War and Peace, despite having spent more time in Alexander I's Russia than Clausewitz and Napoleon together. But as the American presidential election of 1824 approached, three Shakespeare specters appeared to Adams. One was Macbeth, whose unhallowed ambition had won a king his crown but lost his soul. Another was Hamlet, for whom death in dark moments was a consummation devoutly to be wished. The third was Bolingbroke, in Richard II. Oh, who can hold a fire in his hand, by thinking on the frosty Caucasus? Adams tried hard, but he'd begun fearing his own hopes. "We know so little of which is best for ourselves," he wrote in his diary, "that whether I ought to wish for success is among the greatest uncertainties of the election. And yet, I have more at stake than any other individual in the Union." What he meant was what he owed his parents. His mother had seen to it that John Quincy, not yet 8, witnessed the bloodletting at Bunker Hill. His father had him reading the classics in Greek and Latin, and speaking French as a preteen. He'd later add Spanish, German, and Dutch, though never Russian, to his fluencies. The younger Adams was minister to the Netherlands at 26, to Prussia at 30, and a United States senator at 36. While still in the Senate, he took a Harvard professorship in rhetoric and oratory. Following his years in Russia, he co-negotiated the Treaty of Ghent, ending the Anglo-American War of 1812, stayed on as minister to Great Britain, and in 1817 became Secretary of State, arguably the most influential occupant ever of that position. Madison and Monroe had made it their path to the presidency. But because Adams's family expected no less, he'd been preparing his own path since childhood. By 1824, though, the deference that allowed American dynasties, whether of Virginians or Adams's, was giving way to a boisterous irreverence. Elites didn't wear well on an expanding frontier, in cutthroat competitive newspapers, or among freshly enfranchised voters. Gentlemen shouldn't scramble for anything, Adams believed, but not becoming president would be a censure by the nation upon my past service. As well as, by implication, that of his father, so far the only one-term chief executive, still living, and, for Massachusetts, closely watching. Seeking, but not suggesting, balancing fire and frost, had worked for Washington in the late 1780s. It wasn't likely to for Adams, however, in the early 1820s. So, when Andrew Jackson, the next major military hero, won the 1824 popular vote, but only a plurality, not a majority, in the Electoral College, Adams gave up on Frost altogether. The Constitution required the House of Representatives to decide such elections, and there Adams's supporters joined with those of a runner-up, Henry Clay, to make Adams president. He, in turn, made Clay Secretary of State. Whether there'd been a deal didn't matter. It looked, tasted, and smelled enough like one for Jackson and his followers to denounce, furiously, the corrupt bargain. Adams and Clay, therefore, began their administration, historian Sean Wilentz has observed, with a complete failure of political intelligence and imagination, which President Adams tried to repair by marching to Moscow. Not literally, of course, but his first annual message to Congress, submitted against his cabinet's advice in December 1825, mismatched aspirations and capabilities on a Napoleonic scale. From a mandate so minuscule that only he could detect it, Adams asked for everything: a national university, federally financed roads and canals, uniform weights and measures, a stronger navy and a naval academy, the promotion of global commerce, and vigorous diplomacy to bolster the Monroe Doctrine. Indulging his fascination with astronomy, Adams even called for a national observatory, an American version of Europe's lighthouses of the skies, thus opening himself to allegations that his head wasn't just in clouds, but in the stars. To neglect these priorities, he insisted, would be to hide in the earth the talent committed to our charge. For liberty is power, and the nation blessed with the largest portion of liberty must, in proportion to its numbers, be the most powerful nation upon earth. A slumbering indolence, palsied by the will of our constituents, could only doom the country to perpetual inferiority. Adams's message palsied what little support he had left, however, winning him, after less than a year in office, the certainty of his own single term. Perhaps, having abandoned his principles to gain the presidency, Adams hoped to regain them by giving it up. Perhaps he'd always self-doubted. His parents made ambition a duty, but kept reassurance rare. Perhaps he was behind the times. The near future of American politics lay with Jacksonian devolution, not Hamiltonian consolidation. Perhaps he was ahead of his times. A more distant future would resurrect federalism to win a civil war. Probably he saw that slavery would start it and hope to postpone, with distractions, the evil day. Knowing the fragility of the Missouri Compromise, Adams, like most of his contemporaries, hardly dared speak slavery's name. Whatever the explanation, he left office in 1829, much as Napoleon had left Russia in 1812. Exhausted, bereft of allies, chased out by his own miscalculations. But Adams regrouped in a way that wouldn't have occurred to Napoleon. He demoted himself. He agreed to run from his Massachusetts district for the House of Representatives, the only former president ever to seek service there. Winning easily, he took his seat in December 1831, and over the next decade and a half asked for only one thing: a debate on the thousands of anti-slavery petitions he'd put before his colleagues. Although he was often alone in defying the gag rule the House had placed on that subject, Adams prevailed in the end. For just as the Constitution protected slavery, he argued, so its First Amendment guaranteed free speech and the right to petition for a redress of grievances. With persistence, logic, and a principled purpose, he boxed in his opponents. Then, in March 1841, at the age of 74, Adams did the same to the Supreme Court. After speaking for 8 hours on behalf of the Amistad captives, Africans sold for slavery in Spanish Cuba who'd freed themselves at sea, been seized by the American Navy, and through sympathetic lawyers appealed their forced return, Adams reminded the justices that framed copies of the Declaration of Independence flanked them on adjoining walls. How, sitting between these, could they not free the captives? Moved by this invocation of morality, original intent, and interior design, the court unexpectedly agreed. In time, if at tragic cost, the country would too. More than any other American before Lincoln, therefore, it was Adams who placed the Constitution within the frame of the Declaration, all men were created equal, where he knew that the Constitution, as it then stood, couldn't comfortably sit. 1. On February 21st, 1848, the House of Representatives was debating a resolution of thanks to military officers who'd served in the recent war against Mexico. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, concluding that conflict, had gone to the Senate earlier that day. It expanded the United States from Texas, annexed in 1845 before the war, to the Pacific. But despite his earlier transcontinental ambitions, Adams would have opposed the settlement if he'd had the opportunity. President James K. Polk, he believed, had provoked the conflict to bring new slave territories into the Union. The House, however, didn't vote on treaties, and Adams, on its floor that afternoon, suffered the stroke that killed him 2 days later. Abraham Lincoln, a first-term Illinois congressman and fellow war critic, probably witnessed the dramatic event. It was, the stricken Adams managed to say, his end of earth. but also that of the last generation who'd known the founders. Lincoln was born in a ramshackle cabin on the Kentucky frontier in 1809, the year Madison sent Adams to Russia. The death of Abe's mother and his father's neglect left the boy and his sister near starvation at 9 and 12, their clothes in tatters, their hair infested with lice. Adams, as Monroe's Secretary of State, was at the time acquiring Spanish Florida. And when Abe, rescued by a stepmother, felt the need to escape his father, who thought only a year of schooling quite enough, the teenager and a friend poled a flatboat they'd built down the Mississippi without ever having heard of Huck Finn. The year was 1828, and Adams was still president. When asked, years later, to specify his education, Lincoln wrote a single word, defective. That would have been true at the time, though, of most Americans. So what set Lincoln apart? First, his looks, or, as he'd have put it, his lack of them. At an adult height of 6 feet 4 inches, he loomed over almost everyone else. His hands were enormous, his arms too long, and his pants usually too short. He thought his face ugly, failed to tame his disobedient hair, and moved with an alarmingly gangly gawkiness, as if about to run into things and knock them over. But Lincoln seems rarely to have regretted his appearance, taking refuge instead in self-deprecation while reserving, for infrequent use, his intimidating strength. Having found it impossible not to be noticed, he decided early on that he might as well be liked. So he perfected performance. No one used humor more readily, more aptly, or with less recycling. His anecdotes, often scatological, flowed as easily as the paper the shaky banks of his day issued as currency. But the stories never lacked point or purpose. It was said of Lincoln that he could make a cat laugh. Behind the mask, though, was an enduring fatalism, as if something or someone else, probably not God, were directing him. It could have been the shadow of a desperate childhood, or the death of Anne Rutledge, whom he'd hoped to marry, or the exasperations of life with Mary Todd, whom he did marry, or the loss of 2 of their 4 children. Who knows? But maybe also Shakespearean complexities, for Lincoln lived the parts not only of Adams's specters Macbeth, Hamlet, and Bolingbroke, but also of Falstaff, and Henry V, and Bottom, and Lear, and Prospero, and, later of course, in the eyes of his enemies, Julius Caesar. The young Lincoln loved lolling on a riverbank reciting Shakespeare. The stream was the Sangamon, near New Salem, the first Illinois town in which he settled. To the west lay emptiness filled with possibilities. To the east lay property, roads and bridges, the rule of law, the spirit of enterprise, the right of all, whatever their origins, to rise. Lincoln straddled these geographies without committing to either. He tried boat building, river navigation, surveying, military service, rail splitting, co-managing a general store, even serving briefly as village postmaster, but never farming, before finally taking up the practice of law and the vocation of politics to which that led. In both of which, he educated himself. He read voraciously, remembered pragmatically, and applied lessons ingeniously. Oratorical skills smoothed his path from law to politics. Not being ponderous helped. Defeated for the state legislature in 1832, he ran again and won 2 years later. After that, he never lost an election. With Jackson in his second presidential term, political parties had begun organizing across the country. Lincoln chose Whigs over Democrats out of respect for Clay, who'd tactfully repackaged Adams's proposals for internal improvements. The young legislator's more immediate priority, though, was to improve Springfield, where he'd moved, by making it the state capital. With that accomplished in 1839, and with the Whigs having won the presidency in 1840, Lincoln could seek wider opportunities. Wisely, he took his time. Winning elections required assembling coalitions, and in Illinois, that meant waiting your turn. That's why Lincoln didn't seek the Whigs' nomination for the National House of Representatives until 1846. It's also why, having secured the seat, he promised to fill it for only a single term. He arrived in Washington in December 1847, eager to make his mark. So he demanded that Polk specify the spot on which, a year and a half earlier, Mexicans had shed American blood. If, as the president claimed, the war started in self-defense, then who, exactly, had been defending themselves? But Polk ignored him, and Lincoln gained only the nickname Spotty. Uncharacteristically, he'd moved too soon, a mistake he'd avoided in the past and would in the future. Lincoln returned to Springfield in 1849, having failed to snag a patronage plum, commissioner of the General Land Office, that would have kept him in Washington. His congressional service, apart from the Spot resolution, had been unmemorable. Despite its use, throughout his absence, by his partner, William Herndon, Lincoln found his law office so dirty that the seeds he'd sent constituents had spilled on the floor and sprouted. He was 40, and not far himself, it seemed, from going to seed. 2. Within 5 years, though, Lincoln had embraced a cause, acquired a compass, and set a course. It was that of the old man whose last days he'd seen in the House of Representatives, reminding Americans of the uncomfortable position in which, in order to form their union, they'd been obliged by its founders to sit. Necessity was their only excuse for slavery, Lincoln insisted in 1854, and, so far only as it carried them, did they ever go. They'd inherited the institution from the British, knew they'd have no nation without it, but hoped it would disappear on its own. So they wrote slavery into the Constitution without naming it, just as an afflicted man hides away a wen or a cancer which he dares not cut out at once, lest he bleed to death. Less than this our fathers could not do, and more they would not do. Slavery, however, was not disappearing. It was becoming more profitable where it was legal. The 3/5 rule for apportioning congressional seats and electoral votes privileged its position in national politics. It could well spread, by invitation or imposition, into the new territories, soon to be states, won from Mexico. The Compromise of 1850, meant to settle slavery's status in those regions, was already less stable than that of 1820, itself never robust. And even where slavery was illegal, federal laws allowed owners to recapture fugitive slaves. The 4th of July has not quite dwindled away, Lincoln wrote witheringly in 1855. It is still a great day for burning firecrackers. No one fanned more flames over slavery than the man who tried, too cleverly, to extinguish them. Stephen A. Douglas, the senior senator from Illinois, was a fellow Springfield lawyer and frequent Lincoln debating partner, who, although a Democrat, shared the Whigs' enthusiasm for economic development. Both sought to position their region between Eastern innovation and Western opportunity. Both favored, as the first step, an Illinois-based transcontinental railroad. Both knew it would need federal subsidies, land grants, and military protection. Both expected Southerners, wanting their own route, to demand compensation. But only Judge Douglas, as Lincoln called him, thought he knew what it should be. Why not, in the vast Kansas-Nebraska territory, extending west to the Rocky Mountains and north to the Canadian border, repeal all congressional restrictions on slavery and let settlers themselves decide its future? Self-determination, after all, had been enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, but topography and climate ensured that slavery in the new territories would never thrive. Douglas could have it both ways. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, which he proposed and Congress passed in May 1854, would be simultaneously principled and expedient. Instead, it exploded, sending red-hot nails, Harriet Beecher Stowe later wrote, in every direction.